seconds already of bullshit coming through there.
20 seconds of bullshit.
Speaking of 20 seconds of bullshit, good morning.
Good morning.
Why not start it that way?
Mm-hmm.
That's out. So just to give everyone fair warning, we started a little earlier than we usually do today, and then we both promptly told each other stories that made us both angry.
Right.
So I don't know why we started the day like that. All right. So we haven't done this in a while. We've got kind of a couple of topics, neither one of which is really a full episode. So we're going to talk about a couple of things. And we're going to start with, once again, we get great discussions going on our Discord. So if you're one of our hopnologists, you know what we're talking about already. But we want to share that knowledge with everyone.
Exactly.
It's about copper.
Copper.
Copper just seemed to come up this past week repeatedly.
Well, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's all about downy mildew sprays right now. Yep. So, you know, the early season drenches and, you know, lo and behold, oops, it's been raining and I haven't been able to get out and get my fungicide. I'm like, good Lord, we just started the season. People are already behind the eight ball. But that's how it works.
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
And the question came up, you know, it's like I'm looking at what are my options, and then several of these fungicides that are out there that have curative properties require, per the label, to use to spray with copper. And the question is, why? Why can't I just spray copper then? Right? Because that's cheap. And that's really where it came up. It's like, why always are we adding copper? And then why don't I just use copper and copper, everything's copper.
It's not just all the extra pennies you're saving from being in this wonderful industry. You can't just leave spare change all over the yard.
Yeah. I don't think there's any copper in pennies anymore.
No.
But anyway, at least they're mostly zinc anymore, which is another fungicide we could talk about.
There you go.
Like that? Yeah. But that was the whole thing about copper and what is it and how does it work and, you know, why can't I just use copper and hose it all over the place? So I thought it would just chat briefly about copper, its usage, its history in ag as a fungicide.
Well, why is it that all the things that we also use to make money, we also use to make our yards work? There's something poetic in there, and I'm trying to
probably
put it all together.
You figure out how to Instagram that.
Okay. Oh, man.
Well, let's talk about copper here, and then we'll get into our rants. Well, copper is one of the oldest fungicides that we use in commercial agriculture. You can look back hundreds and hundreds of years, but really it wasn't until the mid-1800s or so when copper sulfate was combined with lime to make something called a Bordeaux mixture. And it was used primarily on grapes and things of that nature in France and Europe in order to control what they would call soft rot, or a lot of these fungal infections that would cause, and mildews that would cause rotting fruit. Hmm. And it worked great. So lo and behold, we're growing hops, and hops are, you know, mildew prone, as we all well know. So let's just use Bordeaux mixture on hops. Worked great, right? Lots of copper in there mixed with lime, and Bob's your uncle. Until we started seeing that, well, you know what? When we use these hops in beer, doesn't quite ferment right, if at all. So
oops.
What's going on? Yeah, right. And what we discovered was that, yeah, these high levels of copper coming from the Bordeaux mixture, when they go into the beer, and I'll talk about this, why this happens in a minute, that copper becomes available in solution and basically, I'll say, kills off the yeast. It doesn't necessarily kill them, but it certainly mucks up their enzyme systems. And that means no fermentation. Wah, wah.
That's bad.
So then there was this kick in, certainly in Germany, but this is Western Europe too, and some in Central Europe, to stop using this Bordeaux mixture. Well, you shouldn't need to stop. It's all about timing, right? And how much you use it, and that goes into building resistance and why you rotate your fungicides and X, Y, and Z. So that's sort of the history of early copper usage in the hop industry. And it wasn't really until the mid to late 60s when we sort of dropped the lime component out of this. I'm not talking about limes like you put in your Corona. I'm talking about lime as in the calcium lime. That was added to raise the pH of the solution that you are spraying, because that's at that point, that's when copper becomes, we call it insoluble or mineralized at a higher pH. And it's a particle at that point. So it's not an ion. And that's very critical, because copper ions, when they're able to dissolve into water, that's when they become toxic to the plant. And which is why, like, if anyone's seen a copper label, copper fungicide label, or even on some of our phosphorus acid fungicides like Aleate or Fostrol or things like that, it says do not apply with copper, or copper says do not apply with phosphorus acids, because the pH of the solution is too low, and you turn that copper ion, you turn that copper into ions instead of into a particle, and now it's like game on for toxicity, and it will defoliate your plants. So that's a key point when we're using these copper fungicides, is to keep the solution pH high, you know, certainly above 7, but probably in the 8 to 8.5 range. So copper hydroxide was formed in that late 60s, and then later on there's tribasic copper and lots of other copper formulations that they're all on the basic or alkaline side, simply for that reason of keeping it in, let's call it, particulate form and not an ion form. Here's a cool thing, though. So you're spraying this copper onto the leaf. It's a contact fungicide. So it's not systemic. It's not getting into the plant. It sits on top of the plant on the outside. And it's a particle. You'll see it once the spray solution dries. You'll see it on the surface as a blue ring or a dot or something like that. That's elemental copper bound with other things, but that's sitting there ready to do its thing. And so a spore, fungal spore, mildew spore, whatever, even bacterial, will land on the leaf surface through humidity in the air and rain or dew, just any of that kind of thing. It sort of reactivates that copper on the surface, and the spores take that copper into their bodies, where it is very rapidly changed from the particulate form to the ion form, and they basically poison themselves. That's how that works. So as long as you've got copper residue on the leaf and you can see it, it's going to be active. The problem is, certainly in Wisconsin in the summertime, it might as well rain every night in your hop yard because the dew is so heavy. So you could spray this stuff on there and its residual activity is like 24 hours because it's just going to run off the plant.
Fly off.
Yeah. So the other thing we have to be careful of, too, is that people say, well, I'm getting all these spots all over my leaves. Don't I want a nice uniform coat to kind of kill off all the spores that are there? Yeah, but you really want to avoid adding any adjuvants that change the spray properties to, like, what we call sheeting or filming. And if you want to know all about that in just stupid detail, go back and watch the Joe videos on YouTube, because we talk about that. But modifying that spray solution to get yourself a sheeting action is actually not good, because that copper then can very easily get into the leaf through the stomata, those little openings that are on the leaf, and get into the leaf tissue and cause toxicity that way, even if the solution of the pH of the solution is high. So we don't want to really add any of those spreaders or leaf wetting agents when we're using copper. You'll get toxicity.
Right.
Yeah. So that's copper in a nutshell. Yeah. The way it works is it gets into that spore or that bacterium and kind of wrecks the ability for that thing to create enzymes. It will create the enzymes that it needs, proteins and whatnot, but copper gets involved with how the protein folds, and the shape of the protein and the enzyme determines its activity. So if you screw that three-dimensional structure up at all by wedging a copper ion in there, it doesn't work anymore.
Huh.
And if your proteins don't work, you're dead.
Yeah.
Just end of story. But it takes a threshold you have to creep up on in order to make that happen. And so that's how that works. And it works great. It's a very broad spectrum fungicide. It is relatively low to no toxicity in humans, mammalian, terrestrial, aquatic. Life forms can have some sensitivity to copper, so I know it is used as an algicide in some, you know, water systems, but at very, very, very low concentrations. So in terms of the fungicides that we have available to us, copper is relatively benign. By all means, I think it should be part of your rotation, but it is a contact only. It's not systemic, and it doesn't really have any, I don't want to say staying power. Sure, if you spray it on, you get a drought. It's going to be there a while, right? It's not going to have it, you know, it's going to need some rain to dew or whatever to get it off the leaves, but that's how that works.
And then you have a whole other problem with
you
drought.
You do, right.
Now, Now, one thing that you had mentioned was that, yes, I mean, if it in Wisconsin it's raining every day and it's washing off, but you can have an excessive buildup in the soil when that happens, can't you?
It can happen, yes. If you were, and you will see that actually in some of these older vineyards and hop yards in Europe where the copper levels will be quite high. Because again, it's coming off of the plant, if it's, you know, rain or dew or whatever, as an insoluble form because the pH is high. It's going to hit the soil. And assuming your soil pH is not too acidic, that it's going to stay as a particle. It's probably not going to become available to the plant unless you're doing things like trying to lower your pH or you have a low soil pH, you know, 6.5, 6, or even 5.5. At that point, the soil water can actually take that particle and break it up into an ion. And now it's like game on for plant uptake. And you can burn roots that way and it can become phytotoxic from a root uptake standpoint, not from a leaf or an external standpoint. Hmm. So year over year over year of copper applications can be a problem. So, you know, repeated soil drenchings of copper can build up in the soil to the point where, yeah, you might end up having an issue after, you know, a decade or more of use. But when used properly in rotation, it is a good control agent. But like everything else, right, it's a double-edged sword.
All right.
That's how that works.
Nice.
But the, you know, the other thing we should add though is why do we use them? Like one of the most famous examples is the curzate and the curzate and copper. Curzate is a metalaxyl, is what it's called, type of fungicide, and it is a systemic fungicide. Gets into the plant and is an RNA disruptor. So it gets into the cellular mechanisms and screws up the plant's ability to make RNA, which is pretty important. And so
yes,
does a good job. You've heard that. Yeah. Right? Yeah. Word on the street is RNA is important. But the reason they say add copper, and not only to that one, but to several others, is because much like they do with some herbicides that are on the market, like glyphosate or Roundup type herbicides, where they'll say, you know, kills weeds fast, right? You see, spray it on, and it's like they get a little stopwatch going, and you see this dandelion wilts in like half an hour. That's not the glyphosate doing that, right? Glyphosate takes a long time to actually kill a plant. So they're putting something else in there to give you that fast burn down to help appease you. In this case, it's basically just a consumer perception thing. But in the case of adding copper to some of these other fungicides, it's getting a 1-2 punch, because things like curzate has, you know, no external control, right? It needs to get into the plant to do its thing. So combining it with a copper gives you a little bit more extended action, but also helps to boost the results, so to speak. Huh. Is it required? Do you have to use copper with those chemicals in order to make them work? No, you don't. If they did, it would be in the formulation.
Yeah, exactly.
So what they're saying is if you want the best results, really what they found through their trials, you need to use this with a copper fungicide, spray with a copper fungicide. So just to kind of dispel those myths that, no, this absolutely won't work if you don't use copper with it. No, because the copper's not getting into the plant. Right? The copper is staying on the surface.
Right.
So it doesn't, the copper's not doing anything to change the formulation, physical chemistry, or it might be, but not in order to cause the other fungicide to do its job. That's not a problem. You can't add copper to every fungicide formulation, though, because, again, the pH of the solution may cause a problem. So if the pH is too low, the spray solution pH is too low, you're going to take that copper, change it from its particle form into an ion form, and now it's game on for toxicity.
Oh,
you're
going
to see spray damage, right? So measure your spray solution pH.
And that's the thing. It's beyond, if you're lucky, all you'll do by mixing things that shouldn't be mixed is make them ineffective.
Right. Best and you'll, case scenario. Well, best case, right. And you'll do something what we call crash the formulation or crash the mixture, which is, you know, create precipitates, and you'll see it just, the solution just literally fall apart into solids and liquids instead of being a nice suspension. As far as using copper, go for it. Works great. It's in that class, is it 1M? This is the class of fungicides that it's in, so fairly low, again, low to no toxicity, and at least in fungus and mildew control, there appears to be no resistance buildup that occurs. In bacterial infections, in some other industries, ag industries and ornamental industries, we have seen some resistance buildup on the bacterial side, but not for fungi.
Nice. That's a lot. A lot of info. Go back and listen again with your pencil.
And it's cheap.
Cheap is good.
Cheap-ish. Cheap in relation to, you know, Ritamil Gold. So it's,
It'll just cost you
good stuff.
Just cost you pennies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just pennies. Nice.
Yeah, there you go.
Nice. Yeah, see what you did
that's,
there.
That's all I knew about copper coming into this. Uh-huh. And apparently even that was wrong.
Copper. Pennies are copper-ish.
Copper-ish.
You can melt modern pennies. You can melt on a stove.
Does anyone even have pennies anymore? Like,
oh, sure. Yeah, they're floating
under
around.
The car seat, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, they're zinc. And just they're electroplated with copper. Because it costs too much money to make a penny.
Yes, it costs more than a penny.
Mm-hmm. And probably still, it probably does now, even though they're made out of zinc. But
all right, so that's the copper portion of our program for today.
There's a whole another host of content we could talk about. Sarcastic, cynical James talking about heavy metal usage in the hop yards and how things like lead arsenate is organic. But it's also toxic as hell. But anyway, I will. The soapbox is yours now.
Oh, yeah. Excellent. Excellent. I went to a brewery this week.
Wow. Now, a year and a half ago, that would have been like, okay.
Wednesday.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, that would have been Wednesday. But yes, I got out with a couple of friends who I hadn't seen in a long time. It's been a long time since going out and doing something like that, but it's a place I hadn't been about, I don't know, half an hour from me, that one of my friends recommended. All excited to get out. And so we wanted to talk about, how did we call this? How not to be a brewery?
Yeah, right.
The title of this section.
God.
And the beer was fine, but the business side of it is something that I just... As much as we talk about some of these things, I was observing some things that just didn't make sense.
Grinding your gears, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Things we talk about from a business perspective. And you brought up the excellent point earlier that, you know, we're a hop-based podcast. We talk about beer and beer industry as well. But as someone who's going to be selling hops to a brewery, look for business practices. Look and see what they're doing that may have nothing to do with your hops, but... You know, do you think this is a sustainable business? Do you think it's a business that you want to send people to and say, hey, look, they're using my hops? Are you proud of where your product ends up?
Yeah, what does it tell you about their attitude? Mm-hmm. That might give you some insight as to, well, maybe why they're not calling you back.
Yeah.
Or, you know, they're going to be super eager to use your hops and advertise it all over the place. But is that a good marriage?
So I'll tell you about what my experience was here. Starting out, we knew we were going to this particular place, so of course, I hop online, I look at the tap menu. First and foremost, to make sure I even want to go there in the first place. And the tap menu, you know, a nice mix of things. You saw, I posted it up on the Discord before mm-hmm. before I went. I think I posted it at like 10 o'clock in the morning and said, I'm not drinking yet, but this is what I plan to do this afternoon. Let the hive mind decide what I was going to have, which was fun.
I don't think I saw anything other than the fact that they were $87 a pint.
No, they were $8 or $7 a pint, first of all.
That's still too much.
It's still too much. And honestly, that's the norm around here. Unless you're a member of a, you know, I'm in the coaster club.
I didn't grow up in Westchester County, so for me, that's pretty expensive.
Yeah, it is expensive. It is expensive. And then, you know, it's funny. I go to a Total Wine or something, and I go to buy a single can of something and go, oh my God, I won't pay $3 for that can. And then I realize just how much cheaper that is than going out and
right?
on tap. But yes, $7 or $8 can be the norm. And I say $7 or $8, usually, you know, the Imperials, the heavy ones, for some reason, they believe they can charge more for. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. I think you should charge less because they're gross. But be that as it may. Yes, $7 pints, which I did mention after the fact that I guess because we were there at, you know, starting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't know if it was because we were there early or because it was a Thursday, but those ended up being $6.50. So there's some kind of a deal, maybe because it's not the weekend or maybe because we walked
happy
in the door.
Hour pricing. Happy hour pricing is $6.50.
Yeah, I know. It still sounds too expensive. I know.
That's obscene.
And I have
Japan?
And I suspect a lot of people listening are going to go, well, that's not that wrong. Remember, there's a brewery on every street. Breweries by you are like Starbucks. I mean, you walk out of one and you're looking at another across the street. So supply and demand. This is the only brewery within, I don't know, 25 minutes of where it is. So
that's where they sell. I mean, how was the atmosphere? Was it like, because I mean, there's more to a location, right, than just its beer. It's the whole atmosphere, and they're selling an experience, and so part of that could be wrapped up in the price of the beer. But
no,
for that price, I would expect it to be super awesome.
I mean, fine, I would say. You know, picnic tables out back, a small tap room on the inside. It was a great, but it was a little bit off the beaten path, so you weren't dealing with traffic and car horns and whatnot, you know, coming and going. It was a nice, quiet place. They had music playing very softly, which I like. It was there just enough where if you went, hey, I like this song, or you could ignore what you didn't want to hear. So it was the atmosphere was nice. I could see myself, if I lived that close to it, spending time there just because it was a comfortable place to be, without question.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But let's talk about, and the beer was fine. Beer was fine. It didn't blow me away. I brought a couple growlers that I did not fill. It didn't make me incredibly excited, but it wasn't bad. I didn't take anything back to the counter and go, no. No, it wasn't like that. You did have to serve yourself, but in this day and age, that's pretty common anymore. So going inside, get your beer, bring it back outside. Did not have a lot of staff there, but again, Thursday afternoon. The thing that really set me off, two things set me off. One was, you know, I'm visiting this place for the first time, and I just say, because I'm used to saying it, okay, I'd like a flight of, and she interrupts me and says, oh, we don't do flights.
What?
I'm like, really? You don't do, how am I supposed to know I'm going to like that $87 pint?
Right.
If you're not going to let me do a flight. And she said, I'll let you taste anything. And I almost went all wise ass on her, because you're rubbing off on me, and said, well, can I get a taste of each, please?
Exactly. Get me the smallest glasses that you have, fill them each half up, and I'll decide which one I like.
And at one point, so I did
eventually... Oh, and by the way, I would have paid you for that, but but now you're going to give them to me for free. Idiot.
I remember once being somewhere where they charged you for a taster. And I remember thinking how odd that was and how not customer friendly that was. And for the life of me, I can't remember. But anyway, I'm blanking on where it was, but I remember thinking that was an odd decision to charge for a taster.
Yeah.
Because even if you let me taste five things, I'm going to buy one of them eventually. Eventually I'll find one I like. So I did at one point ask for a taste of something, and the taster she poured me might as well have been a flight portion.
Wow.
It was definitely a 3 or 4 ounce portion of a taster, which I then had to stand there while people were waiting behind me for a beer and basically shoot so I could move on and pick a beer. So the next person could go.
Ugh.
So I'm definitely not taking you to this place next time you're here.
Or maybe if we're feeling that in that kind of mood, maybe you are.
You should. I will say the gyros from the place up the road were fantastic. So that alone.
The gyros? Yeah,
a gyro. Gyro, yes.
Oh, I know. Gyro. Okay.
Again, yeah. New England. We call them gyros. But yes, the gyros.
Right.
Quite good. So and also, no food. But again, very normal having to bring food in. And they have just recently changed the rules around here where you don't have to have it. For a while, it was they could only be open if you ate. You had to have food. You had to have a food truck to be open. So that just changed. And I think that was the whole we're a restaurant, not a bar scenario.
Right.
So the tap list, like I said, the lack of flights was a bit irritating, but you could get a free taster if you wanted to. I should have tried that. I should have pulled a give me one of each taster. And it wasn't even like it was she gave me a little plastic cup. It was she had a little goblet, a flight-sized goblet.
That was your taster?
That was my taster.
Now, were they not doing flights because of COVID or some other reason, or they just didn't do flights?
I got the impression they just didn't do flights. Because very often in this environment, you hear things like, we're not doing that right now, or we can't, or more, you know what you hear? We can't do flights, or something right. like that. Because I know all the places around here for a bit weren't, because they moved to plastic cups for a while, and so they weren't buying mm-hmm. little plastic cups to do flights, because it's kind of ridiculous. They look like, at that point, they look like sample, like urine samples.
Yeah. Cloudy urine samples. Mm-hmm. You're like, you better go to the doctor, pal.
Yeah. When your doctor says that's hazy, you've got a problem. And you've when your bartender problem. Says it, you've also got a problem. Let me just put that out there.
Nice.
There's a hazy sample t-shirt coming your way. I just got to figure out how that's going to work. Nice. So no flights. No flights was a problem. My bigger problem was that, as I mentioned, you know, I was excited to go out. I pulled down the tap list. I'm sharing it with people going, you know, getting input on what I should try. I had my flight built before I walked in the door. I didn't even plan to look at the tap list because I was going to say, I would like, please, your this, 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 and this. I was ready to go. I think two of the beers that were on their online list were actually on the chalkboard when I walked in. It was all different. All different. Hmm. Mm-hmm. Completely different. Tap list was completely out of date. And I had to sort of reset myself. They were not as attractive choices, first of all, as what they had listed on the website.
Yeah, they had a fairly good selection on the website. But did you go on there and they were all IPAs or what?
They were not all IPAs. So there, let me see here. One, there were eight. Why did they have? I'm looking at what ended up being the chalkboard here. There were eight on tap. One, two, three IPAs, three of the eight, so half of them were IPAs, almost half, which were not on the website list. There was a lot more variety, including a lager on their website list, which apparently was award-winning, and that was nowhere to be seen.
Did they get a gold star from their mom? Is that the award they won?
It's entirely possible. Well, that's why, you know, I wanted to try the one that won something. So they mm-hmm. had
It won a silver medal in their homebrew club competition.
So they had a blonde and a lager. They had one of the two or three IPAs on the online list was a sour IPA. And for reasons I can't explain, I actually like sour IPAs more so than regular IPAs or sours. So I was that was not there. They did have a rye pale ale, which was nice to try something a little bit different that you don't see often. But yeah, there were maybe two or three commonalities between their chalkboard list and their online list. And as someone who has dealt with websites for a long time, and not even in a professional capacity, I do it in a podcasting capacity, they're not hard to keep up to date. They're really, really not hard to keep up to date.
So one of the things that thing alone tells me something as a someone trying to sell hops to a brewery like that. It tells me that the brewers are running the business. Mm. And in that scenario, which is not uncommon, but the first red light for me is the brewers are running the business, the back of house operations. Uh-oh. Because brewers make awful business people. Awful. Because they're interested in the beer, they're interested in the brewing process, and everything else is sort of like, yeah, whatever, get around to it. Which means if you do make a sale, it's going to take forever to get paid. Just know that going into it. So that would, I mean, I'd love to be proved wrong. That's fantastic. Prove me wrong. But that would be my first suspicion. It's like, if you don't have somebody keeping your public facing information up to date, what's going on? What are you expecting? Are you just catering to your locals? That probably also might say something about their volume too. Just things that you could keep in mind. You know, if I went in there, looked online, it's like, oh yeah, just like you, Greg, I went in and I'm going to go, because who doesn't now, right?
Oh,
who
sure.
doesn't look online first, right? So it's like, okay, you go there. Certainly for me, if I've never been there before, what do they got? I go there and they don't have any of that. It automatically puts me off.
I was definitely, and I ended up getting the first thing on the chalkboard list because I was like, let me try the WID, you know?
Right.
I was definitely a little bit off kilter from that. And look, I'm a big boy. I can read. I can make a decision. I get all that. So this is a bit whiny, but that's why it gets categorized as a rant.
Mm-hmm.
And we know you love it. We've all been there where you walk in expecting something that that you had anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
There was a one of the new places around here when it was new. This is 4 or 5 years ago when they opened. I went and checked them out. And I hadn't looked beforehand on the website. If I had, I wouldn't have gone. 13 taps, 11 IPAs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I would never have walked in the door.
Yep. There was a brewery I went to in Chicago, popped in seems like forever ago when I taught in person down there. There were 13 or 14 taps, and they were all IPAs, doubles, triples, some sort of smash mouth thing, and a porter.
Can I get a flight with all of it being the porter, please?
Right. No ambers, no lagers, no nothing. It was 13 out of 14 were some sort of IPA abomination. Whether, you know, and some of them had like gummy bears and gumballs or whatever. I was just like, oh, God. Almost turned around and left.
Mm-hmm.
Which I've done before, but I was starving. So
that will do it. Did they have a nice gyro?
They had no gyros to be seen.
But yes, all in all, I will backtrack a bit and say it was great to be out again. It was great to hang out again. I hate to call myself a beer snob because I still don't think I know enough to be a snob. I know enough to know I like what I like, and that's okay. And I also know that I like to try things.
Oh, study hard, young Patton. Mm-hmm. We'll get you there.
Oh, I know. Oh, I know we will. I'm a flight guy. We've talked about this before. I love to just try stuff. So the idea of visiting a new brewery, because honestly, I would have tried all their IPAs as components of multiple flights. I absolutely would have done it. We talked a few weeks ago about that Saison that I tried that I had no interest in trying that I actually ended up loving. So,
mm-hmm.
But man, make it easy for your customers.
A few years ago, I was not a flight guy because I kind of knew what I wanted just by looking at the menu and was into taking the risk and go all in, give me a pint. And because if I don't like it, I just won't finish it. But then the proliferation of poor brewing over the last 5 or 6 years has just got me to the point where it's like, yeah, no, I'm not doing that anymore. Give me a flight. Let me try enough of it so that I can make an assessment before I, you know, go all in. But frankly, we are, Greg, the fact that we're talking about this, we are in the vast minority mm-hmm. of their customer base.
Yep.
And so this brewery you went to, they didn't do flights. It's probably because their people that are coming in want volume. And they're not there for the beer experience. They're there because the place happens to have beer, and it is a cool experience. Two different things.
It's really good point, the experiential part of it. And again, a nice place off the beaten path, small, quiet. It was, it was a Thursday afternoon. And as I said, we got there at 4 o'clock on Thursday when most of the normal people are working. It was, and it was the one sunny day we had here all week. It's been raining. So it was a beautiful day to be outside, and I was with my friends. And you could have handed me those urine samples, and I probably wouldn't even have noticed because I was just having a nice time.
Mm-hmm.
So to your point about experience, they they kind of had that going if you're looking for that. And we've talked many times about what kind of experience are you looking for, a loud band and party games versus, sitting in a corner, having a conversation and being able to hear yourself think, and dogs and kids. And we've talked about all those things before. This, for what I was looking for that day, was the right experience. I just didn't – the disconnect between what I was expecting in terms of the tap list and what showed up when I got there in terms of the vehicle to get it into me and as well as the actual contents was, to everything you said earlier, they weren't thinking about their customers, about the marketing side of it at all.
Right. It's make the beer and make it and they will come, right? Mm-hmm. And those are the cues I pick up on. But I think, the comment you made about, I don't know how I'll rephrase it, basically, frame of mind when one is going to those places, to know if I knew that that's where I was going, I probably wouldn't be as torqued off about it. If I was going to some sort of English tap house in the UK somewhere, and it's down a flight of stairs and in the basement of an old building, I'm not necessarily expecting it to be some sort of craft beer haven. I'm going down there. They're going to have four or five, maybe, hand-pulled taps of national brands and pick one, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that hard. I'm not going in there expecting to have some sort of zymergic experience. But if I am, if that's what I'm expecting and I'm totally off base, I am not going to be happy. And is anything ever really going to be make me happy at that point? I don't know. You might be kind of turned off. So if your frame of reference is important to have. However, I would argue that if you're not going to bother doing something as simple as keeping up your website, or, some people say, well, they keep their Untappd up to date. That says something else, I think, about the audience that they're catering to at that point. But if they're not going to keep their website up to date, why bother putting it on there anyway? We have a rotating list of beers, and here's some of the ones that we've had in the past to give people an idea of what you do.
And, I didn't even think about checking out their Untappd, but, man, update your own website. I would go back there. I wouldn't bother to – I might go to the website to make sure I've got their hours right, if that's even correct. But I wouldn't bother again to get that sense for, hey, are they going to have anything in particular that I'm looking for? And the funny thing is, the chalkboard list, as I look at it, I think if this had been on the website, I think I would have had, it's still a nice looking list. I still would have had expectations and I still would have walked in knowing what I wanted, instead of walked in and being disappointed that they didn't have that lager or that blonde that I was interested in.
Mm-hmm. I know you like your blondes.
Who doesn't? When your doctor says that's hazy, you've got a problem.